From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, dangerously cold weather means extra effort to get people who are homeless into a safe, warm shelter.
We have six teams going out tonight to, like, make sure that no one is left unserved. So we're not going home until every person is off the street tonight.
A Flint art exhibit with a new look at the image of George Washington crossing the Delaware River.
We're not rewriting history, but we're putting the often intentionally removed chapters and stories from history back into the book.
Memories of acting in the classic radio western The Lone Ranger, which debuted in Detroit 86 years ago.
When they did the show, they had scripts in their hands, of course, and they had eye contact. The two of them, I remember the eye contact between The Lone Ranger and Tonto.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And welcome to the polar vortex of 2019. Michigan and much of the Midwest gripped by temperatures that are the coldest in a generation. As of mid-afternoon, there are two suspected deaths in the Detroit area that could be linked to the sub-zero temperatures. Governor Whitmer says that state offices will stay closed tomorrow. And the U.S. Postal Service says there will be no mail delivery again tomorrow. It is just too cold. Let's see how Michiganders are responding to the frigid and dangerous challenge. We begin with Jamie Wojan checking in from Detroit, the program director of the Tumani Center and the outreach team at the Neighborhood Service Organization. Today, the weather in Detroit is colder than in parts of Antarctica, Jamie. So you're out there trying to keep people who are homeless safe and alive on these cold, cold nights. How are you going about that?
Like, right now, our sole responsibility has changed. Usually our outreach teams, our job is to provide access to housing from the streets. But starting yesterday and through probably the end of this cold front, our mission has changed to just keeping people safe. So our teams have been reprioritized to stop what they're doing and just find people experiencing unsheltered homelessness on the street and get them to somewhere warm.
So how many people were you able to bring into safety last night?
Over 20.
So give me a sense. You walk up to someone, you see somebody, near a sidewalk and trying to stay warm. You walk up, and what do you say and what do they say?
Well, it's a different approach for every single case manager and peer support specialist that's out there. But basically, the mission is the same. We identify ourselves. We try to build some kind of rapport with them. We find out what the current situation is, and then we just try to resolve whatever barrier that they're facing. So, like, if it's access to getting to a shelter, if they're trying to get back to a family member's house and don't have transportation, right now we're just like, whatever we can do to minimize or eliminate that barrier to accessing safety is what we're doing.
Were people nervous about the weather as you talked with them last night?
Oh, absolutely. Like, people do not have enough cold weather gear. They don't have hats, gloves, scarves. They don't have coats for this weather. They don't have boots. So a lot of people that wouldn't traditionally access those types of service settings are actually a lot more willing to engage just for this cold front that we're having.
Now, did everyone you encountered last night agree to come with you to a shelter? Was there anyone who said no?
There was one person that refused to access shelter. We did attempt to get emergency medical response systems and the police to assist us. But due to the fact that the consumer appeared to be coherent enough to make a sound decision, they made the determination that she was able to stay in her site as of last night. We have since stepped in and got her to safety this morning. So we know that as of now, she is safe.
I understand that a typical winter day, your approach is sometimes to house people where they are. Can you explain that for us?
Right, yeah. So the mission, overall mission of our street outreach team is to provide access to housing for people that don't access traditional shelter-type settings. So in most instances, like, what we do is we make sure they're safe where they're at. So we make sure that they have warm coats. The Empowerment Plan is where we get most of our coats, and they're a City of Detroit organization. They're sleeping bag coats. So we make sure people have sleeping bag coats, the right cold weather gear, access to resources like where to shower, where to change their clothes, where to get food. And we don't require them to access a shelter setting to go through the navigation process to end their homelessness. So our job is just to meet them where they're at and end their homelessness where they feel most comfortable, whether it be in their car, their abandoned building, under a viaduct, in a park, wherever they feel comfortable. But that changes when there's a safety issue involved now. So our job as clinicians are to keep people safe. So we are really trying to do a lot of motivational interviewing, a lot of encouragement to get people to, like, just access shelter just during these few cold weather days that we have ahead of us.
Now, what about capacity, shelter capacity in Detroit? Is there any danger of not having enough space for everyone who needs it?
You know what? It has been absolutely just incredible, this outpouring of support that we've been getting. Just recently in this last few weeks, the Pope Francis Center, Spirit of Hope Church, CASC Community Social Services, City Rec Centers, they have all opened. They're like either organizations or some space groups that either don't provide traditional shelter at all or are expanding their shelter operations to ensure that no one is left, you know, underserved. Also, like, you know, neighborhood service organization, the Tamani Center, is a 24-hour walk-in center, and we are not turning anyone away at this time. We're taking all these people that are experiencing homelessness and bringing them into shelters. Shelters have not turned away anyone, even at capacity. And then we work on next day to try to transition those people where there's overflow to places that have a space available. So we have not reached a capacity issue. We actually have plenty of space for the next few days, which is what we're most concerned about right now.
Because bottom line, we're not talking comfort. We're talking life and death.
Right. This is just get you into somewhere safe, at least until this weather passes. That is like the sole responsibility and the sole mission of our outreach teams over the next few days, is that everyone experiencing unsheltered homelessness, that they're safe and that they're in a place that we will be able to then find them, follow up, and get them housing down the road. We can't do that if they don't make it. We have six teams going out tonight to, like, make sure that no one is left unserved. So we're not going home until every person is off the street tonight. So I'm super excited.
Jamie Wojahn with the outreach team at the Neighborhood Service Organization in Detroit. Thanks, Jamie, so much.
You are so welcome. You have a great day.
Tough jobs get even tougher when the wind chill is 30 below, especially when you are out there fighting fires. Nobody wants to go outside right now, face it, but for the fire department, duty calls. Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott went over to Ann Arbor's main firehouse and spoke with Fire Chief Mike Kennedy.
Can you just give me a sense of what it's like to be in a firefighter's shoes when you go out and maybe it's on a call and it's as cold as it's been the last couple of days?
Everything is brutal today. Not only does the weather affect our personnel, but it also affects the apparatus. So we have to carry water with us. And so anytime we stop, we have to engage our pumps and constantly be recirculating water. Everything is much more complicated today.
Have you guys had any calls today?
Already there's been about a dozen calls. We've had a lot of hypothermia-related calls, and we've been pretty much nonstop on building systems, frozen sprinkler pipes, water main breaks.
Everybody has that image that firefighters wear a lot of stuff to protect themselves from the fire. How much extra equipment and stuff do you have guys wearing when it's 30 degrees below zero with a wind chill?
Our turnout gear is meant for thermal protection. It does offer some heat in terms of the cold. It also has some added benefit from there. The issue is if we really try to put on too much extra clothing, then it just adds to more fatigue. So there's definitely a trade-off. If you pile up too much, there's kind of a tipping point of you're keeping warm, but you're also adding to fatigue.
What's it like for firefighters? You're sitting at home or you're here and you're warm in bed, you're having some nice warm soup or whatever, and you get a call and you've got to go out. What's that turnaround like, going from warm and tucked in to middle of night freezing cold?
It's what everyone signed up for. So, I mean, certainly it's part of the job. And, yeah, no matter what the weather is doing, if someone calls 911, we're going to go there and provide the best service we can.
That was Ann Arbor Fire Chief Mike Kennedy speaking with Stateside's Tyler Scott. Now, for people who live on one of Michigan's islands, this is a different winter than for those living on the mainland. Drummond Island, for example, tucked into the northwestern corner of Lake Huron, about 60 miles east of Sault Ste. Marie, 249 square miles with a little over 1,000 people who live there year-round. Lindsay Fountain is mayor of nearby Detour Village. What does the coldest Arctic air in a generation mean to your area?
Well, it's very, very, very cold here. It means bundling up. It means, you know, the world doesn't stop, for sure. We have school to go to and jobs to go to, and, you know, we're used to it, and we just bundle up, and we do our best.
So as we in Southeast Michigan, everything is shut down and schools are closed, it's kind of just winter as usual?
for
exactly,
you.
Exactly. Yep, things don't shut down. You know, we have 300 people here in Detour, and we work together, and we have an area that, you know, while a lot of people might have a lot of maintenance crew or, you know, a lot of crew that helps out, we have, you know, one to two people, and we have to do the same that a big city would do. We have to get those streets plowed, and the buses have to run, and a lot of our Detour students come from Drummond, so that's catching a bus on the ferry, coming across the ice, and coming over here. So, you know, the world does not stop.
So now, does the ferry run to Drummond, or is it frozen?
Nope, it runs all year long. The icebreaker comes through. The freighters do stop going, but the ferry does not. They run, they leave Drummond 10 past the hour. They leave Detour 40 past the hour. And if you live on Drummond, you go to elementary school up until sixth grade. And then from then on, you catch the boat and you go to Detour for junior high and high school.
You know, I've got to wonder, are there any tourists or visitors staying in Detour now? Do you see outsiders, or do people kind of say, you know what, we're going to wait?
Nope, it's quite opposite. With the amount of snow, we have snowmobilers, people like to snowshoe. There's a resort on the island that caters to a lot of that stuff, so people stay there. There's more cottages and homes to rent in Detour, not necessarily hotels. But people do stay all year long. All of our businesses are open all year long. And, you know, that's where a lot of places, that's what they survive on in the winter, is the tourism. Because we are mostly a summer area, but when it comes to winter, we rely on those snowmobilers to come up.
Well, I have to note, as you and I speak, I'm sitting here in Ann Arbor, and your wind chill in Detour of minus 16 is higher than our minus 29. So we can say we're colder here
yeah.
than you are.
The vortex is moving down state. So lucky you guys. You guys get it now.
Lindsay Fountain, mayor of Detour Village, right next to Drummond Island. And it's business as usual because it's winter in northern Michigan. Lindsay, thanks for speaking with us.
Of course. No problem.
Coming up, increasing pressure on teachers to meet changing academic standards and raise test scores. What does that mean, though, to the life skills our kids need? Are they slipping through the cracks?
All academic content in the world is not going to be any good to you if you're not able to troubleshoot through life events and circumstances that may happen to you.
Stateside's education commentator Matinga Ragatz has some thoughts. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. She believes in the power of art as a force for love and healing, and she believes in the people of Flint. Artist Vanessa German has just opened her first large-scale museum exhibition at the Flint Institute of Arts. It's called Miracles and Glory Abound. Vanessa German is based in Pittsburgh. She spent a week in Flint last summer working with area kids and drawing inspiration for her new show. Vanessa German, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's good to be with you today.
I know that I read that you're looking to start people talking about public memory and rewriting history through the lens of privilege. How do you do that through your art?
The work of art that I have in Flint right now is a really good place to begin to not necessarily rewrite history, but to consider an entire body of story of history. So when I think about public memory and I think about monuments, that monument is holding a place for a story. And what I found out and have found out through lots of research over the years is that there are stories within stories and stories submerged by literally the monument and by how some stories are amplified. They're just told much louder than other stories. So we're not rewriting history, but we're putting the missing, the often intentionally removed chapters and stories from history back into the book and laying them out on the same plane. So the work that we have in Flint is a wonderful way to begin to do that because it is inspired aesthetically by both the painting, Washington Crosses the Delaware, and So aesthetically, it is an incarnation of that.
Okay, and that's, I should remind everybody, I think, who went through school probably saw that famous painting of Washington leading his Continental Army across the Delaware, Christmas Day, 1776.
Correct.
How are you commenting on that painting? What kind of pieces are you showing to make comments on that painting?
So the work that I have created really is a re-envisioning of that. So in my sculptural incarnation, which is probably exactly as big as the incarnation in the painting, because it's a huge painting. It's like 21 feet long. And so I made a 16-foot boat, and it is populated not by 12 figures, but by not by 13 figures, but by 14, and they are all figures of color. And my Washington figure is a single black mother carrying a small child. And there are lots of symbolic references inside of the work, from the way that I'm using the colors red, white, and blue, which were strategically used in Leutze's painting, but also thinking about Leutze as an artist who was not just capturing a portrait of a moment, but he was working in the spirit of invention and myth. Washington Crossing the Delaware was not painted till 75 years after George Washington died, and it was, and the painting is a completely impossible thing to have happened in real life. So as an artist, I think, where do you take these liberties? What liberties do these story are the liberties that you're taking with a historic moment? What are those liberties doing? What kind of, how are they shape-shifting the story? How are they affirming one part of the story? How are they contributing to a myth? How are they interrogating a myth? And so as an artist, I thought, well, let me create a day in a fictitional city park where the central monument is not Washington crossing the Delaware, featuring a tall white man standing up in the middle of a rowboat, in the middle of an icy river, perfectly balanced. But let me create this vision where I've very intentionally replaced some of these figures. But not only that, in my incarnation called Miracles and Glory Abound, which the acronym is MAGA, you experience the force of momentum to the boat. So in Washington Crossing the Delaware, painted by Leutze, you see that this boat is being propelled by what the artists thought was a representation of everyone in America at that time. There's like a Native person, a woman, a black, an enslaved person, and people from like a Scottish army, and they're all represented in this boat. But in my incarnation, that would be the central monument in this fictitional American city park, is actually being propelled by the figure of a black girl who is bearing the water, but also bearing the story into the future. So I was thinking about who gets to decide what stories survive.
There you go. And as you tell me now, the choice of title, Miracles and Glory Abound, MAGA. So that is, and it is a wonderful title. I know you spent time in Flint last summer. And I'm wondering, you know, where'd you go? What did you see? And how did it inspire and inform this show that's just opened in Flint?
Whenever I do a solo exhibition at a museum, it's really important to me to be inside of the community, because a lot of times museums are treated like exclusive places, and there sometimes a lot of people express to me the sense of not feeling welcome in museums and not necessarily understanding art like that, so they can't see it the way that maybe a curator would see it and won't be able to talk to other people about the art the way that academic people talk about art. So it's really important for me to go into communities and say, you know, museums were really important to my life growing up, and I understood that museums were my place. Like, your museum belongs to you. It thrives because you would go and visit it and bring your life and your experience and your memories and your breath to that building. So it's important for me to go out to communities and to make that connection, because often there has been an intentional disconnection. If you look at a lot of museums in this country, they would intentionally make it more difficult for what they called undesirable communities to enter into the museum, and that legacy still persists and insists today. So when I was in Flint, I went to Burston Field House, which is this historic building where they have dance classes and they've done all types of sports trainings, and it is an integral spot for a part of North Flint. And then I also went to the Boys and Girls Club of Genesee County, and I did several days of power figure workshops where we talked about the power of art and the power of intention and what it means to bring the world around you into your art. We talked about what it feels like to make art, what happens to your heart and your mind, and then to consider the object that you make with purpose. Like, I always ask in the workshops that I do around the country, and in Flint it was amazing because I ask young people, and I did this workshop for kids who were probably three-year-olds to adults who were 88 years old, and I ask everybody the same question. If you could make a work of art that had the power to do anything, what would you want it to do? And where would you want to place that work of art to be useful? So we activate in the workshops that I had in Flint the power of creativity and the power of creativity in action, to be generative, purposeful, to use beauty and creativity as a tool for human social connection.
And when you got responses, especially from the young people, did you see the kinds of answers they gave you? Were they impacted by the Flint water crisis, by the trauma that had been visited on the city?
The ones that really stood out to me never mentioned water at all. Some of them just talked about violence. Mm-hmm. Like, I was really surprised. I had one girl who, from looking at her, if you were to think stereotypically about the children who have in this country, are experiencing the trauma of street death, you would not guess this girl. And on her piece of paper, she said, if I could make a work of art that had the power to do anything, it would stop all of the guns and violence on the street, and it would make my neighborhood safer. And then she wrote a list of names on the piece of paper, and next to each name, she colored in a little heart. Mm. And so there were several people who wrote about making works of art to heal and to protect their families and their communities. The youngest person in my workshop was a three-year-old boy who I had at Burston Field, who told me that he wanted, and because I was writing for him and he was telling me what he wanted to put in his power figure, and he said, I want my power figure to have the power of vegetables.
Oh, yeah.
And then he whispered to me, I love strawberries. And I thought about that. I said, that's really wonderful, because somebody is telling him those vegetables are going to help you to grow healthy and strong and give you energy and power to run as fast as you can. And he had no reason to think that you can't put that same power into a power of art. So we wrote it down, and he was so excited. And so I had a spectrum of things, but I don't think anyone mentioned water.
Well, certainly the art that you've created in this exhibition, Miracles in Glory Abound, are really worth seeing as you really put forth this message of the power of art as a force for healing and a force for love. And we want to remind everybody that Vanessa German, Miracles in Glory Abound, will be at the Flint Institute of Arts until April 20th. So there's plenty of time to come and see this installation. It's been great to meet you, Vanessa. We want to thank you for sharing your passion and your work with us on Stateside.
Cheers. Have a great day.
Schools are certainly feeling the pressure to prove their students have the academic skills to make it to college, pressure to bring up those test scores. The scores are certainly high stakes. The fates of schools, their teachers, and students can depend on them. But what of the other skills that kids need to become successful adults? Skills that are harder to quantify, like resilience, civil debate of disagreements, community involvement.
Stateside's education commentator Matinga Ragatz has some thoughts about what students are not getting when schools are hyper-focused on test scores. Now, school is certainly a place where you go to learn, Matinga. Doesn't it make sense that teachers are focused on the academic?
Complete sense. You know, teachers need to focus on the academics because in most cases, there's important concepts that kids need to know. But, and this is a big one, you know, all academic content in the world is not going to be any good to you if you're not able to troubleshoot through life events and circumstances that may happen to you that are, in a way that it's not detrimental or to yourself or others. So in the age of information, really, we have to really consider that we can do both by dropping some of the things that, mind you, we might consider important, but not essential. So, and really concentrating on the essential things so that we can leave some room to start talking, you know, teaching the kids coping skills.
All right, let's talk about, first of all, the kinds of softer coping skills that kids need. What do you hear from teachers around the state?
Yeah, well, here's the funny thing is that we talk about these skills as being soft skills, right? And we should really stop talking about them as soft skills. We should really talk about them as essential skills, because I tell you what, there's nothing soft about the way life is going to smack you if you don't have these skills. And teachers, you know, they are frustrated by this lack of interest in the disconnect between test scores and the students' struggle with essential skills, right? So it's really, really upsetting sometimes when we simply take an unproductive classroom behavior and we just kind of label it as a mental illness, which is real, right? But then we're not given the time or the support or the resources to understand and learn how to help this student manage that behavior. So we are kind of expected to just kind of radiate this Dr. Phil vibe and somehow change our practice around the symptoms and behaviors that we know we might not always understand.
What's an example, Matinga, of something that a teacher would have had time to do 10, 15 years ago that they just can't today?
Great. Teachers, 10, 20, 30, for decades, teachers have been, you know, taking on more and more parenting roles, and they're proud of that. We're proud of being those front lines. But while in the past, right, a teacher felt they could interrupt the academic learning to raise a young man or raise a young woman, you know, the high stakes testing has shifted that goalpost completely. And now we seem to be caring more about the academic performance and less about that student's real future.
So when teachers are hyper-focused on the academics, so what aren't students learning, and how does that have long-term consequences?
Well, what they're not learning, again, is just the essential life skills. And I think we're seeing it playing out in social media where, you know, people are not coping well with news that they may disagree with. We are seeing it in, I think, the attitudes of our students when, you know, when they have to choose between looking at their cell phones and listening to, you know, and being aware of their society. So I think some of the biggest consequences that I see is that not teaching these kids these coping skills opens the door for them to go out somewhere else and learn it. And I can tell you this much, like reality shows and YouTube videos showcase bad examples of how people, say, cope with boredom. Right. And I'm not making this up. It's all on video. Right. And but the most destructive part, I think, is that schools are wasting so many resources shopping around for these prepackaged programs to help mitigate the consequences of not concentrating on teaching the kids this essential skills.
When you say life skills and coping skills specifically, what are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about things like, you know, dealing with rejection. I mean, half of middle school drama is just dealing with rejection and being rejected by others. I'm talking about a health class that doesn't just teach you how to, you know, the history of basketball, but actually teaches you how to understand what sugar and salt do to your growth journey. In courses that allow the kids to not just learn the academics, but learn it in a context that actually puts them in the middle of the decision-making process rather than just being fed what somebody wrote in the book.
So what's the solution? How do schools keep up with the academic demands and meeting benchmarks and yet make space for these social
and life skills?
Reconsider those benchmarks. I mean, in the age of information, like I said before, you have to reconsider. There are some things that kids are going to be able to find online, and they're depending on us to not necessarily give them that replicate that information in the classroom, but to really help them make sense of the information that they find online. And so if we do not do that, you know, we are going to be, as educators, I think, you know, not the place the kids come for learning. They come there just for us to give them content that's not necessarily relevant to them in their life.
Matinga Ragatz with us via Skype. She is a National Hall of Fame teacher and Stateside's education commentator. As always, Matinga, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Coming up, why it's so important to protect the pets against the extreme cold temperatures.
Especially for the breeds, many breeds that are chained up outdoors, pit bulls, Rottweilers, you know, even the shepherd mixes cannot take this extreme cold, especially with no provisions.
That story in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Today, a golden moment in radio history.
Fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty hi-yo, Silver, the Lone Ranger.
86 years ago this week, January 1933, the iconic radio western The Lone Ranger premiered from the Detroit studios of radio station WXYZ. It was an instant hit, and soon it was picked up by the Mutual Radio Network. So by 1939, some 20 million Americans turned on their radios three times a week to hear the adventures of the Lone Ranger and his loyal Indian scout, Tonto. Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center is here with us. Hello, Rachel.
Hello.
And we have a special guest who spent years teaching drama and running the theater program at Marion and Brother Rice High Schools in Oakland County. Lou Smella was a child actor on The Lone Ranger. Lou Smella, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. I'm happy to be here.
Rachel, for our younger listeners who may not have heard The Lone Ranger on radio or read the comic books or watched the TV show that ran from 1949 to 1957 or seen the movies, briefly, who was The Lone Ranger?
He has an interesting backstory. The Lone Ranger's name is John Reed, and he is the lone survivor of a group of Texas Rangers who were killed in an ambush. He's nursed back to health by Tonto, a young Potawatomi. And once he's healthy, he learns that all the Rangers are dead, including his brother. So he dons a mask and vows to fight injustice.
And who created the Lone Ranger?
The Lone Ranger was the creation of George Trendle and writer Fran Stryker. George Trendle wanted to have a popular, family-friendly show and came up with the concept of this mysterious masked hero. Fran Stryker was a scriptwriter who created the character details and the storylines.
And George Trendle was the WXYZ station owner?
He was.
My understanding was, I've always kind of heard, there were some very strict guidelines for the writers as to who the Lone Ranger was and what he would or would never do.
There's a very long list of things for the Lone Ranger. Things like he's never going to be seen without his mask. And he can't be captured for too long because that's no fun. And if he is captured, he has to use his wits and his smarts to get him out of it. He can never swear. He can't drink. He has perfect grammar with no slang. And the bad guys always have to be Americans. That was to not create animosity amongst anybody else. And they were to not, quote unquote, be put in enviable positions of wealth and power. So they had to be just sort of everyday people who were the bad guys.
Interesting. And so the actors pretty much all came from the Detroit area?
They did. There were three main actors that played the part of the Lone Ranger. George Seton was the first for a few months in 1933. And then Earl Grazer is 1933 until his tragic death in 1941 in a car accident. And then probably the best known Lone Ranger is Brace Beamer. He's from 1941 to 1954. And he's the person that actually went out into public so people could see the Lone Ranger. He was a very tall man, a very big man. He could ride a horse. So he was actually also the public face of the Lone Ranger.
Well, with that, let's turn to Lou Smalla. Lou, tell us about being on the program. When was this and how old were you?
Well, I think I was 10. I might have been 9. My brother and I went to audition. I had done radio for a long time as a young kid, so a studio wasn't anything intimidating to me. And I went to audition, apparently for Mr. Stryker. And he was delighted because he said, gee, kids who can read and act. Because at that point on the radio, if you needed a kid, you got an adult who sounded like a kid. They didn't use kids. And so we were honored to be selected to be the kids that were on the scripted stories of the Lone Ranger, which was very, very slim and very, very rare. We didn't do a lot of work, but when we did, we were either together, brother and sister, whose parents had been killed in some situation or taken away, and the Lone Ranger would find us in a desolate village where no one was alive but us, you know, that sort of thing. We weren't a specific character or characters. We were whatever the script called for the children involved in those situations at the time.
Ah.
When they needed us, they called us, which wasn't really often, but we did get to go several times.
So I'm interested in what you remember most about being on the show. And I guess to that, I've got to wonder, did the actors look like the characters that you imagined through the radio?
Some of them did. Most of them did not. The Lone Ranger did. Oh, gee. Except for the mask, he was perfect. Everything was there. He was a tall, very large man, wore the wonderfully designed cowboy boots, the Levi's and the jacket, the plaid shirt, and he was just so into being the Lone Ranger. Oh, he also had this wonderful hat, and he wore it all the time.
So Brace Beamer embraced this completely.
Oh, he did. He was absolutely the Lone Ranger.
All right. What about Tonto?
Tonto, on the contrary, was in my eyes, a 10-year-old's eyes. He was probably 80 years old at the time. Maybe he wasn't that old. But he was bald on the top and had a ring of silver-white hair around, you know, in the back of your head from ear to ear. And he wore a white dress shirt rolled up with the sleeves and a regular pair of trousers. And he just was... Kemosabe. And I just remember him saying that over and over. When they did the show, they had scripts in their hands, of course, and they had eye contact. The two of them, I remember the eye contact between the Lone Ranger and Tonto. And they acted the roles, even though they didn't move around. What I, again, remember, which I took with me, Cindy, as a teacher later years in life.
Yeah.
I remember them being those characters in the studio where it was just microphones and walls. And yet they were definitely the Lone Ranger and Tonto. And they communicated beautifully with each other. Now, the other actors, I don't remember a lot of women. I just remember men being in there. I'm sure every now and then there were women in the roles. But for the most part, they were people just dressed in regular clothes who, again, though, took on the persona of whatever cowboy or sheriff character they were to be that day, you know, or a person in the town. They just really acted without moving all around. No blocking, no specific kinds of actions. Just their inside body movement became external through their voices. And it was just wonderful.
Now, the Lone Ranger was a very audio-rich program. Did you get any interaction with the sound effects crew?
Oh, did we ever. And of course, being a kid, the sound effects were the big thing at that point. Because, again, before television, we didn't have television. So the sound effects people were in the corner. I remember there was a little half wall between them. But there were these two people, as I recall, who were there, and they had the coconuts for the house, the horse beats, and the squeaky door that would open and close if you needed to close the barn door or whatever door. The floor wood panel that if you needed to walk on steps, or then the sand if you walked on the sand or in the dirt, all different kinds of sound things. And, of course, that fascinated me completely. I was just enraptured by what was going on in the sound corner.
because I didn't have a whole lot to do in the script part. You know, I did my part. I said my four or five lines, and then I was done.
And you could watch the sound people.
Oh, and I watched the sound people, and I was just, we just loved it. We just loved it. I remember that very much, too, but very specifically. For a kid that age to remember what I remember is really strange, but I knew it was something important.
Let's take a listen to a bit of an episode from 1942 with Brace Beamer as the Lone Ranger and talking with Tonto.
A masked man hurried to the saddle shed where Tonto was waiting with Silver and Scout.
Tonto.
Oh, you safe. Me wonder why you not draw guns.
Dane planned that quarrel. I knew he had no reason to shoot me, especially with the sheriff present.
Oh, that's right.
He was after Dutch.
Him chase Dutch out of cafe. Them ride that way.
Dane means to kill Dutch, Tonto. Here, Silver.
Come, Scout.
Who did the whinnying?
Oh, the sound effects people. Oh, yes.
I love it. Hey, Rachel, isn't there some Michigan connection? We all, you know, those of us who watched always heard Tonto call the Lone Ranger Kimo Sabe.
Yes. So James Jewell was a director with the show, and apparently his father-in-law owned a boys' camp up at Mullet Lake in northern Michigan, and the camp was called Kimo Sabe. So the thinking is that's where the term came from.
And now, when the program went national on the Mutual Network, did it still stay produced out of Detroit? Did that change anything? Was it still Detroit with Detroit actors?
It was, for the most part, Detroit with Detroit actors. There was a contract agreement when it went to Mutual Network that it would stay in Detroit into the mid-1940s.
So it went off the air, and then the television show that I'm as a baby boomer, I grew up, it was like not a Saturday unless you watched The Lone Ranger, and that was Clayton Moore who played him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And The Lone Ranger was actually an ancestor of another popular radio drama hero, the Green Hornet.
Yes. So the Green Hornet was also has a birthday this month. He was created in January of 1936, also by George Trendle. And Trendle wanted a more modern character, again, a masked crime fighter. And the Green Hornet's name is Britt Reed, and he is the Lone Ranger's grandnephew.
So cool. Lou, you have spent your life, you know, in the theater. You have taught acting and drama to legions of young people, including, full disclosure, my son, which is how I had the pleasure of having of knowing your story. Those radio programs in that golden age of radio, what do you think those programs meant to working actors at the time?
Oh, they were definitely a way of life. They meant a lot because it was the only place they could work. You know, we did not have television. Radio was the medium which everybody listened to. If I can tell you one quick little story, we would record the show at maybe like 2:30 in the afternoon or something. We would have to get out of school, take the bus. We took the bus in Detroit down to the station, which was at that point on Jefferson, in one of those big, old, wonderful houses near Van Dyke.
Hmm.
And the WXYZ studios were there. And we would go there and we would record it. And, of course, my brother and I, or whichever of us was on the show that day, would then get on the bus with my mother and come home. And all our friends from school would meet us at the bus stop. And we'd tell them all about that episode, although they didn't call it episodes in those days, all about that day's story. And on the way home, we'd talk about it. We'd get to the house and we'd turn it on. And at 5:30, it would come on, and we'd all sit and listen to it together. So the country listened to the radio, and the actors, if they were fortunate enough to be regulars on those kinds of shows, had a very nice living. As I recall, it had been unionized. I don't know when. I know that I had to join the union, the AFRA, A-F-R-A at the time, no television.
No television.
yeah. And we had to be members of the AFRA organization in order to be on that show. So it was nationwide in that regard.
We are so glad we could have you on to share your memories as we mark this birthday 86 years ago this week, January 1933, when The Lone Ranger premiered from the Detroit studios of radio station WXYZ. And we've been talking with Lou Smella, who was a child actor on The Lone Ranger before going on to teach theater for years in Oakland County, and also to Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center. Thank you, both of you, for making this a very, very fun look at Michigan history.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you very much.
This polar vortex, with its historically cold temperatures, presents danger to people and danger to animals. There are animal control officers and outreach volunteers out in this weather trying to help both owned and feral animals. Marie Sklad is president of Animal Care Network in Pontiac. It's a rescue group that tries to help dogs chained up outside of people's homes. Marie, what have the past few days been like for you in preparing for this Arctic air?
Well, Cindy, the last several days have been very, very stressful time of year for the animal rescue community, as well as animal control officers and municipalities covering animal control.
How did you prepare?
We, as we've been hearing about this polar vortex coming, many, many outreach volunteers have been trying to connect with owners to offer them resources such as crates and dog houses, and really trying to communicate to all owners to bring the animals indoors.
Just remind us again, Marie, the risks for animals that are outdoors, both feral and owned.
Well, as they're reporting in many cities, minus 40 below wind chill factors, you know, animals just cannot survive. Even if they have good weight, a good source of water and food, you know, the water freezes quite quickly, as well as a doghouse, they just are not prepared, especially for the breeds, many breeds that are chained up outdoors, pit bulls, Rottweilers, you know, even the shepherd mixes cannot take this extreme cold, especially with no provisions.
So as you go around today, what are you seeing? Are people still leaving dogs outside?
Sadly, people are still leaving dogs outside. You know, some folks do believe that it is an animal and it does have fur and it will be fine. That is not the case. And that they may not realize what they're doing to their animal. A part of our outreach is educating. And thankfully, in our service areas, we have been very diligent with owners to bring the animals in.
So what, give me a sense when you, what, so you see a dog, let's say you see a Rottweiler chained out in the backyard. What do you do? What do you do next?
Our first approach would be to knock at the door to communicate with an owner. We are sensitive to the fact that we want to educate and not be aggressive. Aggression, you know, will bring owners that may shut down. So that we give the owner every opportunity to take us up on the resources that we offer. Should they not do so, or we not able to connect with an owner, we immediately reach out to animal control. That's our next line of defense.
And I guess that leads to the question, do private citizens, if I'm on a walk or I'm walking somewhere and I see a dog in someone's yard that seems to be in distress, have I got any legal right to take that dog?
You do not, as a citizen, do not have a legal right to do so. The challenge is, for those of us that care about these animals, you know, we believe it is our responsibility, as it is, to do something on behalf of the animal. If you call animal control, it is their responsibility, legal responsibility, to follow up on that report.
Marie, what can people do for feral animals who are just too skittish to be brought inside?
Okay, so let's start with the feral cats. You know, many cities consider them nuisance animals. So there are many, many, they call it TNR, trap, neuter, and return organizations that will trap animals in your area, will sterilize them, and then return them. Now, at this point, and I did see a lot of cats running feral in Pontiac on Sunday when I was doing my outreach team. And, you know, they're struggling. They're struggling to stay alive. Those that don't have a consistent source of food or water are looking for places to hide. I would like to also mention that if you park your vehicle outside and you're driving to and from to work each day, your vehicle may be considered a source of warmth. Please pound on the hood of your car in case there are any animals that have decided to use your vehicle as a source of warmth.
Oh, good point. That could be a squirrel. That could be a cat. But bottom line, for pet owners, don't assume that fur is going to protect your pet.
That is correct. Bring them in.
Marie Sklad, head of the Animal Care Network in Pontiac. It's the outreach arm of the Michigan Animal Adoption Network. Marie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Stay warm out there, and thank you so much for listening.